You are listening to the 2015 M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust's Christian Leadership Conference, Understanding the New Millennium, Reexamining the Cultural Narratives. In the first session on the second day, Jason Losey talks about engaging a postmodern world with your organization's story.
What an amazing backdrop for a conference, coming from the East Coast and seeing mountains that look like mountains and not big hills. And the trees and the river, I felt like I was in Twilight, the movie Twilight. It was just fantastic. And then you all meeting you and hearing about all the different things that you do and the organizations that you have, just totally inspiring time. So thanks for having me, and thanks for letting me spend just a really short amount of time this morning, helping to inform maybe a little bit about how you might think about your organization. As Terry started to get at, for the past 14 years, I've been running a design studio called Five Stone, and we exist largely to help folks just like you, folks running nonprofit organizations or social enterprises or just people who see the world in a little bit different and maybe better subjectively way. We help them with branding and digital expression and also organizational storytelling. And so what I want to do today is I want to camp out on organizational storytelling and get at maybe a couple ways in which we can begin to shape culture towards a point of view that I think, or that I hope, is gospel-focused and gospel-centric. And I make a point that it's a culture-bending story because I want to make a distinction between that and stories of fads. So you compete a lot with people giving bracelets and trinkets and dumping ice on their head and all this crazy stuff. And that's probably, you probably raise a lot of money doing that. But I can't tell you, without Googling it, I can't tell you why people were dumping ice on their head last year. So I'm not sure, and maybe you can. I don't have a book to give you, but if you can, Peter will give you a book. actually, I do have a book. So, so I'll give you a book. No. So I can't tell you what they were doing, but I can tell you yesterday, I heard a story in a video of a girl or a kid that got on a horse that couldn't talk and then got off the horse and could speak in paragraph form. That to me is more powerful because I can carry that with me and I can communicate that to other people in a way that I can't when I just dump ice on my head and clog up my Facebook feed. So I want to talk about stories that sound like that. That's what I want to get at today. And here's the reality of the situation. Mankind has been immersed in and telling stories since literally the beginning of time. The creation narrative opens up the Bible and God puts the world into motion. Then you have other stories within the Old Testament like Noah and the Ark. Jesus taught in stories, the parable of the prodigal son and other things like that. And man tells some pretty awesome stories too. We have Les Mis, the old man in the sea, where the wild things are, Sharknado. okay, not all of them are awesome, but the point is they're going on all around us. And the author Jonathan Gottschall, who wrote the book The Storytelling Animal, he makes this point that we are by nature suckers for stories. It's just the way we communicate. It's the way we remember things, and it's the way we relate sometimes to other people. So these stories are going on all around us, and they're a part of our existence. And those stories can be stories of delusion and grandeur and fear, or they can be stories of good triumphing over evil and hope and redemption. And my hope is that as Christians and as gospel-focused storytellers, we are telling stories that sound a little bit more like good triumphing over evil and of hope and redemption. And in fact, when I was talking to Terry and David on the phone, Terry said, man, as Christians, we should be the best at this. And I think, yeah, we should be the best at this. We have a really great set of tools that we can use that a lot of people don't have access to or don't see the same way. So I want to take a minute then and ask, what is your story? What is the story you're trying to communicate with your organization? You may not be trying to communicate anything. And that's a problem because whether you know it or not, you actually are. And people are interacting with it in some way. So what's your story? What is the thing that you want other people to know about what you do? So first, let's define story because we've been hearing the word, we heard the word narrative a lot the last couple of days, or yesterday. And now I'm using the word story. And so I would suggest that a narrative is this sort of overarching thread that's running throughout all of society, and you probably have a narrative attached to each one of the identities that you wrote on that list yesterday. There's probably some stream of narrative that's attached to all of that. Well, a story is sort of like taking a bite out of that narrative, packaging it up, and then communicating something about that narrative to someone else. So it's an encapsulated expression of ideas, facts, knowledge, and motion. So it's a emotion. So it's a nice little package, and you can tell things about the world inside of this story, and you can make sense of other narratives going on around you. At its very simplest, a story has three components. It has a character. It has characters. It has conflict, and it has some form of resolution. Your organization has this too. You just use different words. You use words like stakeholders and beneficiaries, or you use words like donors and fans and followers. Those are your characters. You have conflict also. You might have inner office conflict, but you might have like conflict within the world that you're trying to fix and solve and work towards. And then you have resolution, or you have the idea of resolution sitting out there. And when resolution happens, we see this new state of normal in the world. If what you're doing works or doesn't work, that everything will be different as a result of that. And it might be good and it might be bad. And so these are the three components of a story. And when we talk about organizational storytelling, your story does one of two things. First, it frames up what you do. It's a way to communicate to other people what your organization stands for and how it works and the programs and things that you participate in. And so we don't. When you're listening to a regular story, it's kind of easy to identify because it has a name like a movie and a book and a piece of art and a dance routine. But here we use words like mission, vision, pitch, brand, UI, UX, messaging, donor engagement, model, programs, messaging. All of these are bits and pieces of your story. And all of these are strewn across throughout every single interaction point you have with the rest of the world. And it's communicating something about what you do. The second thing, so it frames up what you do. The second thing a story does is it shapes where you go. Story, in a very real way, is a portal into the future and to what you imagine. And so two generations from now, do you want people to be telling a story of Sally Struthers? Or do you want them to be telling a story of Compassion International? Sally Struthers, maybe, would be awesome, but I hope it's more like Compassion International. And so when we think of story, we can think two generations ahead, and we can start to imagine what we want our stories to sound like, and then we can create literal roadmaps through our mission and our vision and all of those ideas in order to get us there. One of my favorite books of all time is by Tim O'Brien. It's called The Things They Carried, and it's set in the Vietnam War, and it's very literally about the things that they carried on the back, and then the things they carried emotionally and psychologically. And in the book, he says this: the thing about a story is that you dream it as you tell it, hoping that others might then dream along with you. And in this way, memory and imagination and language combine to make spirits in the head. There is the illusion of aliveness. And when we think about story and what it can do for our future state of our organization, this is the idea. It's a way to get people to dream with you. It's a way to get people to use language to describe where you're going. So we see story then in the organizational context doing two things. One, it's the story we want to tell and how it can affect or shape our mission and our vision. And then we have the story we are telling, which proves that it's working. So why bother with all of this? My donors just want to know if we, hit our targets. They just want to know about numbers. And probably that might be true, but my hope is that you're constantly trying to communicate with other folks. And story can be a good way in order to do that for a couple reasons. First, good stories capture imaginations and shape worldviews. We talked a little bit about all these stories going on around us. Well, there's actually another story that's unfolding in Scripture that's happening too. So it goes something like this. God created the world, and he thought it was pretty awesome. He declared it beautiful, and it pleased him. Satan came slithering onto the scene, and things got a little wacky, and sin entered the world. After that, we have Israel, and then we have Jesus on the scene, and then we have the founding of the church, and then we have this future state of redemption and hope and new heavens and the new kingdom and new earth. So a lot of theologians would suggest that we're somewhere between those last two acts. And we are participating in this, and God has sort of set the stage, and he's directing it, but we're in it now. And then so as Christians, we're called to actively participate in that story. And so as a result of being in that story, we have to get a bearings on where we are in the grand scheme of things. And the book was mentioned yesterday, Colossians Remixed, by Brian Walsh and Sylvia Keesmaat. They make this point. Here we are within an unfinished script, and at least some indication of the final act. And we have to improvise. If we are to faithfully live out the biblical drama, then we will need to develop the imaginative skills necessary to improvise on the cosmic stage of creational redemption. So they give us two hints here as to what's going on if we want to be active participants in the biblical story. First, improvisation, or as the poet Peter Riley calls it, the exploration of occasion. I think in a business or organizational context, improvisation looks a lot like what you're already doing. You've seen the need to create something or to fix something, and you've stepped up and said, I'm going to do that somehow through my organization. So for the purposes of our conversation today, we're going to assume that improvisation is covered and we're going to move on. Second, they talk about this idea of imagination, or as George Bernard Shaw says, the beginning of creation. And this is where things get interesting to me, because imagination is sort of bubbling up inside of you, and it's a point of view that maybe you have that others don't have, and then it begins to express itself in some creative ways. And today, that creative way that we're talking about is story. And so stories can be this powerful yet simple tool for capturing people's imaginations around what you think and what you believe and what you see, and inviting them into that. There was this movie years ago called Crash, and it was directed and written by Paul Haggis. And if you're not familiar with it, it was about a couple different peoples whose lives literally crashed together, and their views of race were all challenged on all sides of the conversation. They were all challenged by the other people as they met with and interacted with people that were different from them. I had a buddy named James. I guess I still have him, but I have a buddy named James. And in college, when this movie went out, he went and saw it. And James grew up in backwoods Virginia, and he had a very particular view of race and equality, and had a lot of stereotypes swimming around in his head. James came out of this movie, and he was completely floored by what he had seen. And it profoundly affected the way he viewed other people. So much so that fast forward 20 years later, and he adopted two biracial children. So what's interesting about that to me is we see a story of changing the way someone has behaved or changing the way someone sees the world. And I think story can be a backdoor into the systematic process of change. Now, I don't know what James went through after he saw that movie. I don't know what kind of went on in his head and how he processed all of this, but something happened. And my thought is maybe we can tap into that, because at the end of the day, within your organization, you need people to change the way they see the world. You need them to be lined up a little bit more with how you're seeing the world. Because when we're attempting to make social impact, which I think is what all of you are doing, for a long time, for sustainable change, you're asking one or more stakeholders to fundamentally change their behavior. And you can't really change a person's behavior until you change their basic assumptions about the world. Story is a fantastic way to change someone's basic assumptions about the world, because it allows them to see things in a new perspective and from new angles, and it gives them a new experience without actually having to literally experience it. So, I don't know what James went through, as I said, but I experienced this a little bit ago. By the way, Herbert Simon, the famed sociologist and Nobel laureate, says, "Everyone designs who devises courses of action aimed at changing existing situations into preferred ones." So as storytellers, we're actually designers. So we're not just getting up, and it's good if you make people cry and laugh and all that happy stuff, but actually what we want our stories to move someone through a process of change, and we want to take them from their existing state and move them to a preferred one that's more in line with how we see the world. So as I said, I don't know how this happened for James, but I know how it happened for me. I grew up in Virginia, and my dietary palate was a lot like Terry's. It was beef. And we ate so much meat that my grandmother actually cooked our vegetables in fat back. So our vegetables had meat in it. And so meat was a large part of my diet and my existence, and it wasn't very broad. Well, something happened about 4 years ago, and I became a vegetarian. And so I started thinking, what happened to me that I would give up a core part of my identity, one of my threads, of meat eater, and convert into something that just makes it more difficult for folks like Mary to get me a meal at an event like this. Well, I went through a systematic process of change. And I've outlined it here because I think it's a good way to start thinking about how your stories might take someone through a process like this. So I don't believe this to be universal, but I believe it to be a good foundation for thinking through how you might want to move different people through parts of change through your organization. So here's what happened to me. First, there were some cultural influences out there. I picked up a book by a guy named Michael Pollan called Omnivore's Dilemma, and it was interesting to me. And it's, you know, like that thing when you're thinking about buying a car and you're looking at a Honda Civic and all of a sudden you see there's like 9 million Honda Civics? Well, the same thing happened here. There's 9 kabillion books on this. and so when you get in that stream of thought, you become aware of them. So the book begat an article, that begat another book, and that begat another book, and that begat a documentary. And so all this stuff was swirling around in my head, and it was kind of all happening over time. So this is 4 things that represent maybe 2 years of change. So first, all of these things I read understood that I had a basic assumption about the world that meat was good. Very much like a caveman, meat good. And they knew that, and they talked to me on that level. They didn't assume I thought what they thought. They just approached me where I was, and they said, you know what, you think meat is good, there's value in you thinking that, let's offer you something different. And so they designed some messages to counter what I already thought, and they said basically meat is not all good. And when they gave me those messages, they wrapped them up in a form of storytelling and a form of new experiences for me that challenged that assumption, and they asked me to maybe eat less and buy better. And the way they asked me to eat less and to buy better is that they gave me stories of people who had done these things, and I noticed that they hadn't withered away and died, and that they seemed to be healthy, productive people, and their molars didn't fall out because they weren't, you know, all the things that you hear are going to, crazy things you're going to hear happen. None of that happened to these people in the video or the story that I read. And so I thought, well, maybe I could buy less meat. And then so I bought less meat, and that gave me a new experience in and of my own that I could then partake of, or that I could then communicate to other people. So inherent in that is an action point, buying less meat. And so this happened over and over and over and over and over again until finally one day I was like, you know what, I think I just stopped eating meat. Now, the first book I read didn't advocate for me to be a vegetarian. The first book I read just advocated for me to think about my diet. But over time, something changed. And so I would suggest to you that the first story that you tell or the first engagement you have with someone, you can't expect them to necessarily change their course of behavior. This is long and steady work, and it takes quite a bit of time. So that's the first thing stories do. It shapes imaginations and basic assumptions about the world. The second thing it does is it creates empathy. We heard a little bit about this in the talk back with Alyssa. She mentioned the idea of empathy. There's a pretty famous story. I think it's made up, but it's famous nonetheless. And it's about David Ogilvy. David Ogilvy, some consider to be the father of modern day advertising. And the story goes like this. One day he's walking down Madison Avenue to work, and he notices a guy, a homeless guy, sitting on the curb, and he looks down at the guy's cup, and he's holding a sign, and it says, "I am blind, please help." Ogilvy looks down at the guy's cup and notices that the cup has no coins in it. So Ogilvy reaches in his pocket, and instead of pulling out a coin, he pulls out a pen, and he changes the guy's sign to this: "It is spring, and I am blind." Ogilvy goes away. He comes back later that day to go home, and the man's cup is overflowing with coins and money and things like that. I'm not blind. I have no idea what it would be like to be blind. But man, can't you imagine being in the park in the spring and not seeing the little grass start to bud up? Can't you imagine what it would be like not to see the blossoms on the tree, trees begin to bloom and all the vivid colors that are there? Yeah, that's empathy. It's this idea that you can be in someone else's shoes, and for a moment, you can see the world as they see it. Well, stories do that. Stories allow you to see the world in a different way. Crash allowed James to see the world in a different way. This story allows me to see blindness in a different way. The other thing that's cool about empathy is it actually leads to action. There's a neuroscientist named Dr. Paul Zak. He did this study, and he told a group of people a story about a young boy that had cancer. And the boy knew he had cancer, but the dad did. The boy did not know he had cancer, but the boy's dad knew he did have cancer. And so the whole story is about the struggle that the boy's dad is having playing with the son, knowing that his son's going to die. What he found was that when a story follows a basic dramatic arc, so if you'll hearken back to English 101 from high school, exposition, rising action, climax, falling action, and resolution. When a story follows this basic structure, no matter how simple the story is, 2 chemicals are released within the brain. The first chemical is associated with distress, and the second chemical is associated with empathy. Now, here's the cool thing. What the doctor found was that the more of the chemical in your brain that is associated with empathy that was released, the more money you would give to the cause related to the story that you were hearing. They could actually predict of the money they gave you to participate in the study, they begin to predict how much you would give back to the cause based on the release of the chemical associated with empathy. So here we see the brain releasing chemicals that literally cause us to move towards action through story. So I think that's a pretty good reason to tell your organizational story. The third is good stories are memorable. We work with an organization called Matchbook Learning. They go into underperforming schools around the country and they try to turn them around. There are crazy stats associated with kids not being able to read or do mathematics or things like this. There's crazy stats about the poverty level and the socioeconomic conditions of these folks. And Sajjan's model, the guy that started Matchbook Learning, is pretty compelling and interesting in how he does it. If you ask Sajjan what he does, he rarely tells you any of that. He tells you about this kid named Jalen. And Jalen goes to school at this place. He gets himself up every single day by himself, and he goes into a school that's failing him. But what we know about Jalen is Jalen actually has a dream to one day be a CIA agent. And so what Sajjan does is he helps Jalen realize that dream of being a CIA agent. Awesome. That's all you need to know about what Sajjan does on day one. Because what that does is that allows you, it makes Matchbook's efforts personal and specific. There are a kabillion places trying to turn around public education in this country. None of them have the story of Jalen. Only Matchbook Learning does. So it makes it specific to what they're trying to do, and it makes it memorable. And then it takes all of the facts and stats about education in America, and it puts it back inside that little capsule, and it allows Sajjan to give it to someone, and then they can take that home, and they can tell their spouse or their friends about this kid named Jalen who wants to be a CIA agent when he grows up. Okay, you with me so far? Great. Oh, by the way, at the end, we are going to pause and do a couple exercises. Terry mentioned that. I should have mentioned it also, in case you were thinking they were going to be happening throughout the time. Okay, so how do we create a culture-bending story then? So if that's why we tell it, and now we have a little bit of context around what makes, you know, why would we do it, how do we start getting at this work? Well, I'm going to suggest to you that we can't figure it out in an hour. As C.S. Lewis says, real things are not simple. So I don't care how many emails you get from Donald Miller next week telling you to come to some workshop to learn how to tell your story, you can't figure this thing out in an hour, and you can't figure it out in a week. It's going to take lots and lots and lots of time. So my hope is that today we can spend some time just looking at some frameworks that will get us pointed in the right direction so that when you go home, you can Google how to do the rest of it. No, so that you can get pointed in the right direction and begin doing some of this work on your own. Okay? So here's the framework, and I'll walk through all of this. At the bottom, you see these arrows. Where have we been? Where are we now? And where are we going? So remember, we have these narratives that are living outside of us, and we're in them. This is that. These are the questions that help us identify what these larger cultural narratives are. So where have we been? Where are we now? And where are we going? I'll talk through each one of these. Once we have a basic understanding of like all of this stuff, we can then start to think through what would make a compelling story. And we need to know those ideas because we need to communicate to people who are inside narratives that maybe we're not in. So we have to understand our narrative and their narrative and all this stuff going on underneath of us so that we can begin to get at a compelling story. I would suggest that all compelling stories have three threads. One is a cultural thread, one is a personal thread, and one is an aspirational thread. And so we'll talk through what each one of those things mean. First, let's start with these underlying questions. Where have we been? So if we want to know where we've been, we have two really great sources that we can pull from. One is Scripture. Scripture gives us a way to see the world that lines up with how God sees things. Kevin Van Hooser, the theologian, says that theology is about faith seeking understanding. What it's trying to understand is God, but also ourselves in light of who God is. We're in His image, we're in His world. Particularly, we're trying to work out our relation to God and God's relation to us. And so we need a rich theology around what we're doing. Now, I ask people their theology on their place of work all of the time, and I get answers that sound something like this. God cares about poor people. God cares about injustice. And man, I don't want to demean those answers because they're certainly true, but they're also kind of like, well, no duh. I mean, yeah, of course. No, I mean, that's not a unique thing. A lot of people care about poverty and injustice. So what I want to suggest is that we have to start digging around. And when we start digging around, then we have another tool that we have to get at called history. And I'll tie these two things together here in a second. So I'm reading this book right now by Brian Stevenson called Just Mercy. If you haven't read it, you should go get it. I was crying on page two and haven't, except for right the second, I haven't put it down since I picked it up. Brian Stevenson is a lawyer, and he runs this thing called Equal Justice Initiative. And he helps people who are incarcerated for life or on death row who didn't get a fair trial for some reason. Okay? So that's what he does. And it's fantastic what he does. But as you're reading it, you realize that it's not just about injustice or people wrongfully accused. You realize that it's about race. And you realize that it's about socioeconomic inequality. And you realize it's about deep-seated hatred towards other types of people and laws that were put in place in order to keep one people out in the system and one people out of a system. And you realize that the Supreme Court was taking part in all this. And the things that you have to become aware of in order to accept what he's doing or to have a full understanding of what he's doing are complex, and there's lots of them. And I'm suggesting you need a theology around all of the things that orbit your organization, not just the main thing. Because if we're gonna react and we're gonna live in this pluralistic society with all these cultural narratives, we have to have a point of view, we have to have a theology on all of it. We have to know how we're interacting with every single piece of it. And so I would love to encourage you to take time, if you haven't, and I'm sure you have, think through all of the different narratives that are intersecting with your organization and start developing or thinking through theologies around those narratives. Some questions that we can start asking ourselves to get at this. What does God say about what you do? Not just the thing, the main thing that you do, but all of the things that orbit around it. And what is the history of your field, and how does that align with Scripture? Okay? So next, where are we now? Back to Walsh and Keesmaat for a minute to complete the quote I started earlier. A little bit later on, a couple paragraphs later in the book, they say this: if Christian life is a matter of living in an unfinished drama, then the improvisatory discipleship to which we are called requires something of a double immersion. We must be immersed in the biblical story, and we must be immersed in the world. Only through such a double immersion will we have an ability to discern faithful improvisations from missteps or dead ends. Think through what was going on with Peter last night and how people got off mission. I would suggest that one way people get off mission is because they can't read the culture around them, and then they react in really crazy ways in order to make up for it. So we have to understand where we are now so that we can act in proper ways and we can understand how people are seeing the world. One of the big things that I deal with a lot is people tend to write what they want to hear versus writing to the audience that they're speaking to. So stories come out really great for the person if you're just telling it to yourself, but oftentimes they don't sound great to the person hearing it because they're not in the same cultural narrative that you're in, they're not in the same stream, and when you look at where are they now, or when you look at where are you now, and you personalize it, you begin to realize that you might be in a different place than someone else. That's why I can stand up here and say Trump is giving messages of delusion and grandeur and fear, and my dad can text me and say, man, Trump's awesome, we should all vote for Trump, because we're just in different places within this underlying narrative. So we need to be aware of that, and we need to recognize that. So what's going on in the world around us? In politics, in history, in science, religion, arts, in market conditions, in the nonprofit world, right? What are these things that are going on around us? And then only when we truly understand what is happening around us can we engage our world intelligently and effectively. You can be in the world more fully if you're a critical, thoughtful, insightful reader of the world around you. Back to Van Hooser again. So it's important that we know where we are so that we can operate in it in a way that is effective and intelligent. So where are we now? As it relates to your organization, what is the shared meaning of your stakeholders? And how does that align with Scripture or history? So our next foundational question is, where are we going? This book came up yesterday too, Ta-Nehisi Coates, In Between the World and Me. It's one of the most beautiful books I've read in a really long time. I have to agree with Greg yesterday, you should go out and get this book. If you're not familiar with it, Coates grew up in Baltimore, and the whole book is a letter to his son, and it's about how his body has been um, his body has been broken over the course of time because of his race. And it gave me a perspective about race that I had no concept for or of. And it opened up in a big way, just like the other stories around Meat and Crash. It opened up my imagination. And there's this line at the beginning of the book, and Coates says, "I tell you now that the question of how one should live within a black body, within a country lost in the dream, is the question of my life." And I saw that I saw that line, and I stopped reading because I think it sums up perfectly this framework that we're getting at. So there's hints here of where we've been. How should I live within a black body? That hints back at cultural and historical missteps. Within a country lost in the dream, that's in Coates' point of view, that's happening right now. That we've been sold something and it's not happening. And that's the question of my life. So it's unanswered. He hasn't been able to resolve it. So that's pointing towards something new and different and out there. And so in a really beautiful way, this sort of gets at all of the foundational questions that we've been talking about. Because really what he's doing is he's allowing me to see something in a different way than I saw it before, just like we've been talking about. And that's really what the imagination is. And when we talk about that where are we going question, that's what we want to get at. What do we see out there that we need other people to see the same way we do? Wendell Berry says, "For humans to have a responsible relationship to the world, they must imagine their places in it." So tying all of these things together, we have to know where we are, where we've been, so that we now know, we can understand where we are, so that we can be responsible in it and point people to where we'd like to go. And I think that when you do this, it starts to sound a lot like the kingdom of God. Dallas Willard says, "God's own kingdom or rule is the range of his effective will, where what he wants done is done. The person of God himself and the action of his will are the organizing principles of his kingdom, but everything that obeys those principles, whether by nature or by choice, is within his kingdom." So when you think about where are we going, you want to point towards this stuff. You want to point towards the kingdom of God, and you want to point towards where God's effective will is taking place. And we want to take people there with us. So where are we going? What do you see? Are you joining with God in every aspect of your organization? Okay, so what happens when we start to get at these answers? And by the way, I don't think this is like you sit down and figure this out. Like, this is something you wrestle with all of the time, I hope. But when you get at, you see something start to take shape. You see that you get an understanding of the world, and you get a vision for the future that can actually be compelling. We did that exercise, I forget, yesterday. We had to do this, this, or this. And I think that when you can start doing this, you can start putting your thumb up a lot more, because you have a hope that comes from understanding how all of it works together. Walter Brueggemann says that a community rooted in energizing memories and summoned by radical hopes is a curiosity and threat to current culture. And that's what we want our stories to do. We want to point people to a positive threat to their way of thinking. All right, so that's our foundation. And then we have our three storytelling threads on top of that. Again, they're cultural, personal, and aspirational, and I'll walk through each one of those, and then we'll see if we can sharpen our pencils and start thinking through some of this stuff. Okay, so first, cultural. Within culture, this is basically, in traditional storytelling terms, this might be our exposition. This is the context where the story is taking place. This is our background. This is our situation and all of that stuff. And we're looking for ideas. We're looking at our current culture, and we're looking for ideas that we want to build up and for ideas that we want to tear down. Sometimes they're going to be for the things that we see, and sometimes they're going to be against them. I always come back to this artist, Ai Weiwei. He's a Chinese artist and activist, and this is one of his installations. This is 9,000 backpacks. And he did this after a Chinese earthquake killed a bunch of kids who were in schools that were built in a poor way. And Ai Weiwei said, you know what, if we don't do something, people are going to forget about those kids. And so it spells in Mandarin, "She lived happily for 7 years in this world," which was a note one of the moms had written about one of the children. And so what's happening here is Ai Weiwei, through this piece, is pushing back against something. And I love the way he says it. If we don't push, there's nothing happening. And so I want to suggest that when we look at the cultural part of the lens, we're talking a little bit about how we might push against or push something forward. And we're trying to figure out what side of this conversation are we on. So what's going on in culture? What's going on around me? What forces am I responding to? And what am I fighting for or against? So that's the cultural part of the story. Next, we have the personal thread. Flannery O'Connor, the great Southern writer, kept a prayer journal when she was in college, and they published it a couple years ago. So my primary takeaway is that if you get famous, you should destroy all your personal thoughts because someone might publish them. My second takeaway was this. She wrote this in one of her entries. Dear God, tonight is not disappointing because you have given me a story. Don't let me ever think, dear God, that I was anything but the instrument for your story, just like the typewriter was mine. So in a real way, O'Connor is talking about this idea that God is using her to write something and that she's an instrument in God's hands. What a cool idea. What a cool idea that God is actually using us when we actively participate in his story and that we are a tool for him to accomplish his will. What a fantastic idea. So if that's true, then I feel like we should talk about that. I feel like that should be part of the story that we're telling. And so when we talk about the personal part of the story, we're talking about this. And in some ways, if this were a traditional story, we'd be talking about the inciting incident of the story. Robert McKee, who wrote the book on story, literally it's called Story, says that the inciting incident is the event that radically upsets the balance of forces in the protagonist's life. So there was something happening that seemed normal. Something happened in your life, and now things are different. That's the inciting incident. And so when you think about your story and when you think about how you got involved, what got you to where you are now? It might be one thing or it might be a lot of things. Sarah Miller, who I met through Praxis, who you'll hear about Praxis later, was going to school in New York City, and she was going to be a dancer or an artist or something of that nature. And she met a homeless man, and in that encounter befriended him, and ended up dropping out of school and moving to, it's true-ish, dropping out of school or finishing school and not being an artist. I don't know, but the point is this. She ended up moving to the poorest neighborhood in New York City, in the Bronx, and starting something called A House on Beekman to help single moms parent their kids in a better way. Her inciting incident was meeting that man and altering the course of her life. Now, I don't know that you have a grand story like that. Maybe you don't. It's not important. That you do necessarily, but it is important that you inject someone into your story for that personal perspective. So that might be you. And when you do, you're talking about how you're going to intersect with that cultural narrative. And this should be your quest to right the wrong that you're out to fix. Every story has, we talked about it, character conflict resolution. The more conflict that you have in your story, the more interesting it's going to be. If you didn't have conflict, it would be a super boring story. if I told you a story about, hey, I walked over and got coffee and came back, that's totally lame. If I talked about how I walked over to get coffee and like a dragon came out and people were throwing stuff at me and there was fire, that'd be an awesome story. I got the coffee and I came back and I never thought I'd make it. That'd be fantastic. So we need that conflict, and when you have to have the personal side of the story in order to get at the conflict. Now, you may not be able to tell your story, one, because you don't want to, or two, because it's boring, or whatever reason, but there's parts of your story there's other people involved in what you're doing, and you might want to tell their stories. If you met Cole Cresilius yesterday from Crochet Kids, he does a fantastic job of telling his story, or telling the story of the people that make the hats that they sell. And so all of a sudden, I'm invited into this relationship with someone that I don't know, and I'm getting a point of view around how I think about the products that I'm consuming and my relationship with the maker of those products, all because they're introducing me to someone that I didn't know, and they're injecting a personal part of it into the story. The other person that you can invite into the story are your advocates, your fans, your donors, things like that. I think Charity Water does this in a really great way, where their story is so compelling that I want to give up my birthday, or I want to take pictures with yellow tanks or whatever these people are doing, and all of a sudden I'm featured on their website and I'm part of their story that they're telling. And so we have three different people. We have three different people types that we can inject into our story. The first is what's going on in you. What was the inciting incident for your work? Why have I chosen this work? What conflict is there that I'm trying to resolve? Next, what's going on with your beneficiary, the person that you're serving? What personal experiences do others have? How are they impacted by your work? And then next, what's going on with your audience? What action points, big and small, can I give? What is my audience doing to make the story theirs? And what are the, why are they engaging with me? By the way, back to this idea of change over time, I implied something, but I'm not sure how implicit I was. When you tell someone your story or when you meet someone for the first time, it's really tough to ask them the thing that you ultimately want them to do. So you have to give them small ways to engage with them. You have to give them micro actions along the way. And you have to figure out how much they know about you in order to give them the appropriate action point. So if I'm just meeting you for the first time, probably don't want to ask me for $100,000. Probably don't ever want to ask me for $100,000 because I don't have it. But that's the point. You don't know me enough to know that that's not a good ask. But if you're meeting me for the first time, be completely appropriate to ask me to follow you on email or to follow you on some sort of social media outlet. And then you can begin to tell me more of your story later. So we need those little action points to get people into the story. Okay? So we have cultural, then we have personal, and then we have the aspirational part. By the way, all of these things sort of get mixed up and become become tools for telling the same story, even though I'm talking about them as three separate things. So aspirational. We talked about this idea that we're in the middle of a narrative and we have scripture that we can look at. Well, scripture gives us a hint at what we want to aspire to by doing by asking this question that John Frame asked. What do theologian John Frame ask? What do God's norms direct us to believe? And so when we think about our work and our setting, we want to think about what does God direct us to believe, because that's what we're pointing towards, and that's the aspiration, and that's where our imagination needs to have its eyes set on. We did some work for something that ended up being called Adoption Journey, and we were trying to get folks to enter into the adoption process. Well, I don't think it's any secret that the adoption process is hard and is perceived to cost a lot of money. And so what we found was people would enter and bail out at the first sign of trouble. But as we talked to more people, we realized that some people bailed out less, and these were people who viewed adoption as a calling. And when you viewed it as a calling, all the kind of nuance and technicality and problems that you have with adopting, they seem to kind of like not matter anymore. And so we thought, well, that's great. That lines up with what we think God's norms direct us to believe. Boys and girls should be in a loving family, and everyone is called to serve the orphan in some way. That might be adoption, it might be some other way, but everyone's called to it. So why don't we start talking about adoption as a calling, and why don't we just look for more people that sort of see it this way, and then we can communicate to them, and there'll be less people bailing out. So by looking at what do God's norms direct us to believe, we can have a messaging that points to that and is aspirational in nature and begins to create that new state of normal that we talked about with resolution. So what's your normative? How do you see the world, and how does that line up with how God sees the world? Now, if this were a traditional storytelling, this would be called the resolution. But because we're talking about an organizational story, we might call this something more like your vision. And so I want to take a quick side trail here and talk about mission, vision, and strategy real quick. Because a lot of what I do in my day-to-day is unravel all of this stuff for folks and help them put it back together so that they can have their organization pointed in the right direction and not drift off course at some point. So, mission. When I do work with Praxis, we talk about it this way. What are you doing? Very simply, your mission just answers this question. Kevin Starr, who runs the Malawi Foundation, says your mission should be 8 words, and it should be verb, target, and outcome. How many people here have an 8-word mission statement? Hey, all right, you get a book. So verb, target, and outcome. So it sounds something like this: save endangered species from extinction. Improve African children's health. Okay, so this is mission. Then we have vision. Vision answers this question: what will the world look like if you accomplish your mission? So Teach for America's vision statement is something like, one day all children in this nation will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. Now, their mission statement is probably something that sounds like improving children's education. So the vision is pointing us to what the world would look like when we're done. And then we have strategy. So Teach for America's strategy is probably something like, or how are you going to do all of this? What are the tools that you're going to use to accomplish it? Teach for America's strategy is probably something like, place the best, brightest people into public education, make them teachers, and then work in underdeveloped areas. In the future, it might be have robots. I don't know. But for now, it's this. So the strategy can change if you stay on course with the mission, And I would suggest that the simpler and more dialed in your mission is, the less likely you are going to be to drift later on. And all of this works together to give us a compelling story that people can get bought into because it simplifies it and allows us to start taking bits and pieces of it and giving it to folks in ways that they can relate to. So what are you aspiring to? What is your normative view of the situation? How ought the world look? And how will I accomplish this work? So once we have all of this, sort of fundamental work, once we start chiseling away at this, we can begin to figure out how to distribute it. And we can distribute it in a bunch of different mediums. We talked about them before. It's your mission, your vision, your strategy. It could be the UI or UX of your digital thing. It could be the programs that you're partaking in. It can even be the people who you're requesting money from and who you're requesting money not from. This becomes part of your story as well. And if you don't have some of these things figured out, anybody with money sounds appealing. but when you have some of this dialed in, you realize that your time would be better spent talking to particular people. And so the mediums can be just about anything, any way that you want to communicate what you're doing. So what happens though is you end up creating what I call portable language. So you have this set of raw materials. And you can mix it up, and you can take pieces out of it and put it over here. And you can begin to talk to people with this portable language. And you can give the language to other people as well. Now, the reason this is important is because when you're interacting with a regular story, like a narrative piece, I read it. It's getting kind of late, so I'm going to put a slip of paper in it. I'm going to close it up and put it on my nightstand. And tomorrow when I come back, the piece of paper is in the same exact place where I left it. And so the author is taking me through a very linear process to work me through the idea so that I get everything that's happening. You don't have that luxury with your organizational story. And so what happens is two things. One, people start to think they have to give all of the information all of the time to everybody. And so recognize that the audience doesn't know everything is important to organizational storytelling because I can give them the pieces that they need to know at that time. So recognizing that the audience doesn't know everything is important to organizational storytelling. Accepting that they don't have to know everything is paramount. I don't have to get everything about what that organization does with the horses and the animals and the girl that can now speak in paragraphs. I have no idea what that place does, but it sounds awesome and I want to learn more. That's all I needed to know yesterday. So if you can release that idea, what you find is that what ends up happening is you release control and instead you focus on building relationships. And when you're building a relationship, you don't operate out of fear. So I'm not scared if you don't get everything that I do all in one shot, because I know that we'll chat again later about it. And I know that you're going to get what you need out of my story right this second, and then later you'll come back to it when you're ready and you'll get another piece. This also means you can't assume you have to release some assumptions. So you might have put some content on a video somewhere, and you might have put some other content in a blog post, and there might be a tweet somewhere. You have no idea if someone interacted with all three of those things or one of those things and which one they interacted with. Now, really smart people can help you figure out which ones they interacted with and create sequences to get you to the other ones. But for purposes of our conversation, you have to know that sometimes people don't know everything about your organization that you do, and that's okay also, because we can continue talking to them over time. So we don't have to cram everything into every single piece of communication. And then finally, we have to iterate. We always talk about it in the way that Pixar talks about it. We don't finish, we release. You're not going to get this right the first time. It's going to be clunky and weird, and you're going to want to say it a different way the next time, and people are going to give you feedback, and they're going to say, I don't get what you're talking about. And that's okay. We live in a pretty digital world. You can delete it later and start over. Just don't print 100,000 of them, and you'll be fine. With that said, I would like to take how much ever time we have left, which by my estimation is about 10 or 15 minutes, Terry, okay, and talk through this. So I asked Dave Blanchard to give me a hand first. Dave is with Praxis. He's going to speak next, so it'd probably be a good time to go catch up on email maybe next. Dave and I and Josh Kwan, who's also with Praxis, work together quite a bit helping organizations, nonprofits, and social enterprises work through some of this stuff. And so, Dave, I thought it would be great if I could get this off of here, if maybe you could just react to some of this based on your experience and some of the stuff that you're seeing with the nonprofits that you're working with.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I'll say too, Jason has, he's worked with, we've had about 84 organizations go through our programs. Jason's worked with all of them, for-profits and nonprofits, to help think through this, and he actually gives this talk with us as well. And I think the funny thing is, you know, a lot of the nonprofits we work with, they're younger organizations, but a lot of them are 3, 4, 5, 6 years into what they're doing, and I would say about 90% of them don't actually know what they're doing. And you know what I mean by that? Like, they have an orientation towards what they've been doing. They have a mission statement. They have a vision statement. But if you really press them in on what is it that you are actually trying to accomplish, what's your 8-word mission statement, whether it's 8 words or not, what's the outcomes you're seeking, and how are you really pressing in on that? It takes a long time to unpack it. And so I think it's a really important exercise. And the thing that that we see, I think, and Jason, you can talk more to this probably, but the thing that we see is that these organizations, they're not just trying to tell story externally, and they need to figure out how to tell other people what it is they're doing. They actually need to tell themselves what they're doing, and as leaders of those organizations, and then as their team, because if you're actually not so clear, and you're using these sort of ambiguous, opaque words to describe mission that sort of everybody in the room could use in our mission statements, then there's this confusion about how do we actually make decisions organizationally about what we're going to do? How do we know whether we're on mission or off mission? That's back to that what Peter was talking about last night with the intentionality and the clarity. It'd be interesting if you all kind of rated yourself on that. Where do you feel like you are in that process? And then more so, where would your executive team put yourself? And I think that's the challenge. And sometimes we laugh too, because we have a limited amount of time at Praxis, and we say we have 11 days with them. We could probably spend all 11 days throughout the year just figuring this stuff out so that the organizations have an anchor to go forward in the right way.
Yeah. So I agree with all that, obviously. And that's a nice segue, David. What I thought we would do maybe is do a quick exercise. Now, or three. And I know that a lot of you have probably spent time wrestling with some of these things around mission, vision, and strategy. But I thought, wow, we're talking about a postmodern society. Why don't we spend some time today deconstructing these things that we already have written down and see if we could get at it. By the way, I have this if you want to write it down later. But let's take some time, and Dave will be up here to help answer questions if you have them. But I thought it would be cool, even if you've already done this and you feel great about it, and your mission statement is etched in stone on the side of your building, I thought it would be cool if we could just start over for a couple minutes and pretend like it wasn't etched in stone, and pretend that you could make it whatever you wanted. What would you make it today? And I would challenge you to do it in 8 words or less. Even if it ends up being more later, just for today, just for this moment in time, see if you can squeeze it into 8 words and get the essence of what you're doing. As you're working on that, I want you to think about your vision. What will the world look like if you accomplish your mission? Now, if you can handle it, I would love you to draw a picture of that. Some people freak out when I ask them to do this. But when you do that, it opens up a different side or part of your brain that you don't normally use, and it will challenge you to think about it in a new way. So, if you can condescend for just a minute to sketching something, try to do that. If not, write a sentence. And then finally, your strategy. So this all sounds great. Great mission, vision. The world's going to be fantastic. Thank you for doing all that. How in the world are you going to do it? So spend some time thinking through that. And if you have a question, just yell it out or whatever. And Dave will do his best to answer it while I drink a glass of water.
Add something to what he said. He doesn't know this, but if you were in the breakout yesterday with us, we talked about one of the things you can prototype on this is by really kind of like drawing a billboard. So if you're uncomfortable just doing the visual, think about what it would look like if you drew the mission of your organization, the vision of your organization on a billboard, where you have maybe 6 or 8 words and a picture to represent it.
Thank you, David. Good idea. And we'll just take a couple minutes doing this, and then we're going to talk next with the time we have about how to communicate the different types of people.
And just for accountability's sake, we're going to ask you at the very end to tell the people around your table what you wrote down.
Over the course of the next couple of days. One more thing. We're actually going to take a break, but I thought I had one more thing for you to think about. And if you'd love to go get coffee, that would be fantastic. Otherwise, you can work at your you can obviously do whatever you want. You're grown people, but... if you'd like to stay,
this would be something to think about as well. So one of the things I kind of got at was oftentimes when we write our story or tell our story, we tell it to our own ears. And this is fantastic if everyone you talk to thinks like you. I'm going to suggest that not everyone thinks like you, for better or for worse. And so you have to kind of get at the way other people think. One really simple way to start, the best way to do it is through customer feedback and talking to them. But since we don't have that today, another way to do that is to ask two questions. Well, first of all, list out who the stakeholder is that you want to talk to. So an example of a stakeholder might be a donor. An example of a stakeholder might be for the example, or for Sajan, the matchbook learning, a stakeholder would be the principal of the school, or the student, or the district, all of these folks. So you can have as many of these as you want, but if you want to just think of it in the context of like a primary stakeholder, the main person you communicate with, and a secondary stakeholder, the other people that you communicate with, that would be great. Fill out who that is. And then ask, thinking through the lens of empathy for them, what do they want as it relates to what you're doing? And then how can you serve them in that way? Now, sometimes it means you can't give them the thing that they want. And that's okay too, because you have to know what they're wanting in order to reposition what you can give them in a way that is helpful and appropriate. So really simple exercise, write down the name of the stakeholder, write down what they want. So if I could pick on Matchbook again, the stakeholder might be principal of the school, and the principal might say, I want a school that is functioning and thriving and has boys and girls that can get at a grade point level that is at, you know, national standards. And then what Matchbook would say is, to the principal, we can come in and help with X, Y, and Z as it relates to your problem. So it's sort of like a call and response exercise. So we'll take a break. We can go get coffee and other things that Terry has prepared for us, and you can sit and do this. And thank you guys for your time. I really appreciate it.